I'm Gabriel Spitzer. This is Sound Effect. And this is a boy I met this week. He's really into basketball.
That's my thing, to shoot hoops. I'm planning on, and when I go to high school, I'm joining the varsity team. Down low for defense and forward for offense.
I'm not using his name here because he's 13 years old. And for other reasons that'll be clear in a second.
We're living in like a shelter. It's kind of like a home, but it's like you're living with different people.
And how long have you been in that kind of situation?
A few months.
A few months?
Yeah, almost a year.
How do you handle this stuff at school? Do you tell people what your situation is?
No. I don't tell my friends. I tell like my counselor and my teacher sometimes, but I keep it away from my friends. Yeah.
Why?
Because like I don't want to get bullied and laughed at, because like they all have their own houses and they all have just stuff that they want, and I don't get that kind of stuff, so they might think that that's funny and stuff like that, so they might not be my friend no more.
He says it's not that hard to keep this stuff secret. I guess seventh graders don't ask a lot of questions about housing status. But they do notice certain things.
Like sometimes I wear the same clothes to school and there's questions being asked like through the whole day. Like, why is this? Why is that? I just can't tell the right answer.
And how do you deal with that?
I just keep it inside. Like, I just can't tell the truth to them. It's just really embarrassing if I do.
Coming out can be scary. And it can be complicated. You think, sure, the door is either open or it's closed, but based on the accounts in this week's show, it's rarely that black and white. We have stories of coming out today on Sound Effect from KPLU. We'll hear them right after we talk over this week's news, as always, with a few journalist pals. Don't go away. We're hitting the highlights of the week's news now with our panel of keen observers. I want to welcome Rachel Lerman, who covers retail and tech at Puget Sound Business Journal. Rosette Royale is an independent journalist based here in Seattle. And Alex Hudson writes for Seattleish, the news and politics blog. Hey, guys. Welcome to Sound Effect.
Hi.
Hi.
Hey, everybody.
Okay, so just to lay it all out very transparently for everybody, we are recording this on Friday morning, and you're probably listening to it on Saturday morning. And so everything that you know about what's happened in the last 24 hours or so, we do not know yet. And that is the case every time, but this is a little bit more relevant this week because our top story this week, which is the May Day demonstrations in the Puget Sound region, is still unfolding. And so how we're going to do this is, instead of giving kind of a blow-by-blow of the demonstrations and the response and all that, we are going to talk a little bit about what underlies the actions of May Day, what it means, how it's different this year, and some of the issues that are involved. So for starters, the day's actions kick off with a Black Lives Matter a rally, and one of several that have happened this week. And obviously lots has happened this week nationwide. And I wonder how this movement is resonating here in Seattle now. And Rosette Royale, maybe we could start with you.
Sure. You know, I guess I'll talk about it a little bit by stepping back from Seattle for a moment. So I grew up in Silver Spring, Maryland, outside of Baltimore. And so I had a great conversation with my mother the other day, sort of about what's happening in Baltimore, the protests, the actions. And, you know, my mother has this great perspective that she, you know, is upset about the looting, as you want to call it. That's the word that people use, looting, right? The destruction, property damage. But she so understands the angst and the passion that people have, and how people are so angry still, all this stifled anger, now have these avenues that we all know about. And so she, my mother, like talks about Black Lives Matter, right? My mother's 76, right? So that's there in Maryland. And I think about that when I hear about these protests here in Seattle, that there must be these older people who are looking and seeing all these young people out on the street, like protesting for the lives of Black people. And not just Black people protesting, but white people, Asian people, Latino people, Native people, like this whole, it's like the community, the fabric of the community is coming together to support and to stand up for Black people. It's something my mother couldn't have imagined. And it's something that I was told not to believe could happen myself. And I'm 47 and I'm seeing it right here in my city, just unfurl on the streets. And I think it's beautiful.
Well, it's really interesting the way you talk about it. It's not confined to just African-Americans protesting on behalf of African-Americans. It's kind of spanning a lot of demographics. And in this case here in Seattle, it's inflecting all of the actions that happen on May Day. The immigrants and workers' rights rally has components of this involved in it. Certainly the anti-capitalist or anarchist marches incorporate the things that are happening in the zeitgeist around Black Lives Matter too. Is this a different May Day, Alex Hudson?
I think that it definitely is. I remember May Days in the last, you know, 5 or 6 years were very much about immigrant rights and when immigration was sort of the top story of our country. And now that that has sort of taken a step down as we've had some small bits of progress on those issues, and it's undeniable that these issues are completely linked to each other. As every day we're seeing more stories about police brutality. I'm a white person, and I'm encouraged, and I grew up in a time and place where checking and evaluating my white privilege was absolutely part of my entire college education. And so I think that's why you're seeing more allies out there with people, because you realize that it is a societal problem and that we all are impacted by and affect. So I absolutely think it's a different May Day than we've ever seen before, and for good reason, because movements should move as the culture does.
I'm just going to add to Alex's answer. I think this May Day is different because of the wealth distribution in this city. I think we're absolutely seeing the distribution of wealth, the wealth gap just grow and grow and grow, especially in, I mean, I'm a tech reporter, especially as more tech companies are moving in with very lucrative jobs, which of course contributes a lot of very positive things to our community and positive things to our economy. But it's also just the wealth gap in this city is getting huge. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. I think that we have tried a couple of things to try to tackle that issue, $15 minimum wage. Of course, we don't know exactly how that's going to play out yet, but I think that that is just growing and growing and growing. And I think that that's going to that is contributing to this year's May Day.
And echoing through any kind of real conversation about capitalism and its effects and its discontents. Well, another thing that's emerged out of the Baltimore stuff is people's attitudes around property destruction or property damage as an act of civil disobedience or as a petty crime or as a whatever. It depends on mm-hmm. how you sort of see it, right? And I wonder, Rachel Lerman, covering retail, covering tech, covering the business community, how do downtown businesses and others see that as compared with how, say, an activist or just a member of the general public imagines it?
That's a good question. I think that obviously if you have a retail business downtown, which many do, you don't want your store to get broken into. You don't want, and that doesn't necessarily mean that you don't support these protests, that you don't support these rallies, these marches, but destruction of property for these businesses, especially the small ones, can take a huge chunk of profit away from them. But I'd like to point out, and Alex brought this to my attention, that last year, although there was some destruction of property, the protest leaders, who did not destruct the property, ended up compensating the businesses for that. And I think that we have a good community here where you are able to speak up for what you believe in and also hopefully not put a lot of harm on other people.
Well, it's a really interesting position a lot of these businesses are in. I was just reading how the Capitol Hill business community is kind of digging in and getting ready for what happens. And that neighborhood has been a center mm-hmm. of a lot of the unrest and the property destruction, too. And they're at such pains to emphasize their sympathy with the causes that underlie a lot of the protests. But they're saying, you know, sort of very gently, but please, you know, don't break us.
I mean, I also think it's just important to do a reality check. And some of the taglines that you've been seeing online are really poignant, which is like, I'm so disgusted that we live in a society where there's more hand-wringing about a broken window than a broken spine,
mm-hmm.
right? And so at the end of the day, if people are angry, it's because they live in a culture where the police and the systems of power are more interested in protecting property than protecting people. And so how could you not be enraged by that?
First of all, let me say that you can break a window, but then how do you break the institutional oppression that has been weighing down on people of color for decades? Like, how do you break that, right? So you have this rage inside that's been really taught to you that you're not supposed to do this because you will get in trouble. But if you act good, you're going to – that's what I was taught. If you act good, if you're a good black boy, then you're not going to get in trouble. But we keep seeing that doesn't happen, mm-hmm. right? So then we feel that the stories we've been told are false. And so there is rage about it. And so you strike out. So I feel like a good thing about a protest is it gives you some way to bind with your community, with your allies, so that you can all be together and find solutions to break the yoke of oppression. But also there is the individual rage, and how do you express your individual rage? And I feel like we have not come up with cultural solutions about how to do that. And so there's the window, and that's the place where the rage goes.
Well, you're listening to Sound Effect on KPLU. I'm talking over this week's news with Rachel Lerman, Rosette Royale, and Alex Hudson. Now we're going to talk about our underreported stories of the week. Rosette Royale, what's your underreported story?
Well, it's not for the week.
For the millennium?
For the millennium, oh. I'm going to say. Mm. I think the underreported story is the transformation of Pioneer Square.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Here we are. I used to work down at Pioneer Square. There's Occidental Park right there. A lot of homeless people. Elliott Bay Book Company used to be there. Now it's gone. A lot of businesses were closed down. A lot of empty places. Now there's like new restaurants, new. And I've eaten in those restaurants. Some of them are really nice. You know, I love them. Lunch places, great. Mm-hmm. But there's so many, and they're getting a little bit more expensive.
Hmm.
Now Weyerhaeuser's coming in, building an international headquarters right there in the square. It's going to be a like seven-story smoky glass building. Right, it's going to be overlooking right on Occidental Park. And so what's going to happen to all these homeless people here? This whole area is changing. And I know we're seeing all these big cranes in Capitol Hill, and we're looking at that transformation, which is unsettling. But here, this really historic district is totally changing in front of our eyes. And it's not going to be a safe place for people who really had very few places to go. And so we were talking earlier about like people having to move out of the city, but what happens when you don't have the resources to move out of the city? What happens to you then?
This is, and we should mention that you for quite a long time were as assistant editor of Real Change and did a lot of work right in that neighborhood.
Yeah.
So it's kind of like a mini little South Lake Union, but with a lot of vulnerable people in there.
Yes. Yeah. Oh my gosh. I think it's really going to be something to watch over the coming months and years.
The first thing that happens to people when you're in poverty is that you get denied access to private space, right? And so the fact that the encroaching pressures to also be denied access to the last remaining public space that felt safe and had a sense of community and where your friends were and where all your resources were, it's scary.
Yeah.
Well, that's a great underreported story. Thanks for that, Rosette Royale. And how about you, Alex?
So my underreported story was the nomination of the new city council person. And I think there was a lot of discussion, and however you want to kind of frame it, about, you know, Okamoto, who was ultimately selected. So Sally Clark stepped down. She had said that she wasn't going to be running anymore, and then stepped down to take a position at the University of Washington, leaving a vacancy. So they went through this sort of process to select a new person, and we ended up with John Okamoto, who had been the mayor's candidate and was supported on a 7-2 vote ultimately. That's not really my story. My story is that we have a complete lack of process, right? Like, there was no written down process of how that was mm-hmm. supposed to work. There was no established criteria about how that person was to be selected. Like, I'm all about, like, criterias and numbers and, like, ranking systems and all of that kind of thing so that we can have a transparent government that's, like, accountable, as opposed to just allowing the executive come in with their preferred nominee and do all that palace intrigue stuff that happens in City Hall and then ultimately come up with his candidate when he's already got another candidate for the District 9 position. And I just feel like John Okamoto may prove to be a good candidate or not. You know, that's to be determined, but I don't feel proud of that process. I don't feel like that's a process that is well established. And I don't think that the city council people should feel proud of that process at all. And if this is going to happen again, which it will, I mean, Sally Clark was also the last time that this happened. That's how we got Sally Clark. And, you know, you can say how you think that went. We need to get this stuff written down. We need to get this codified, because having it just be, you know, however they feel about it and having it really be open to accusations about partisanism is not the kind of democratic process that we want for a very important position in our city.
And Rachel Lerman, you are the last woman standing. What's your underreported story?
There's a rumor. It's not confirmed. There's a rumor that Google is looking for space in Ballard. That in itself is kind of an interesting story. Google might be moving to Ballard, but I think it hints at quite a larger trend, which is that in this city, we largely had big tech companies either on the east side in Redmond, Bellevue, or in South Lake Union. They've been growing in Fremont. Now they're running out of space in Fremont. They're moving to Ballard. I mean, Ballard is nowhere near the center of the city, really, if you're looking at the city proper. And I think that that just shows the huge tech boom that's happening in this city, which, again, I mentioned this earlier, is great for our economy, lucrative jobs. It also is very detrimental to income inequality in this city, and it's growing like crazy. And I think that there are definitely positives and negatives to that, and it's something that we need to keep an eye on, and I don't know that we're having quite a lot of public conversation about it.
Yeah, and between them and Expedia, I mean, we're seeing kind of a tech sprawl, right? We're sort of, they're not concentrated into certain districts. It's really
absolutely
popping up everywhere.
And Inner Bay is not even a place that I really think of, to be honest. I drive through it sometimes, and Expedia is moving to Inner Bay, and Google might be moving to Ballard, and, well, the traffic's going to be bad.
Traffic. We got to crowd surf our way over to Ballard for our new tech jobs.
Brings it all on home to traffic. Well, thank you so much to our panel this week. Rachel Lerman of Puget Sound Business Journal, Rosette Royale, freelance journalist, and Alex Hudson of Seattle-ish. Appreciate you guys being on Sound Effect.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah.
Thanks so much.
It was great.
You're listening to Sound Effect on KPLU. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and this week we're talking about coming out in all kinds of different ways. So first off, we have a story about how coming out often is not an all-or-nothing thing. It comes from a woman named Veronica, and it's about a friend.
So I nearly lost Jane when she pulled away from me to step in front of the number 49 bus as it was barreling down Olive Way.
Veronica told this story to about 75 people in a Seattle theater. It's part of a storytelling series called A Guide to Visitors. On stage, Veronica spins this pretty intimate tale about struggles with mental illness, which came to a head when she nearly lost Jane.
And that was a pretty horrifying moment. I was terrified thinking about what I was about to see take place right in front of my eyes. But I was able to grab her hand just in time and pull her back, and I didn't lose her, not then. But I should probably start the story at the beginning, right? This is a story of love found and lost and found again.
Jane, we're told, is Veronica's best friend, and we learn more about that as the piece goes on. The story follows Jane as a precocious kid who's really smart and has an active imagination. And as a teenager, those qualities give her a rich inner life, but they also lead to her being kind of ostracized sometimes. And then we hear about her transition to college.
She was doing really well. She regaled me with all of these stories about the people she was meeting and the ways in which her world was expanding, and it sounded really great, but she was still struggling. She came home one day sobbing because she was convinced that when she went out to go get some food, people were pointing her out on the street and making fun of the way she looked and laughing at her. We found out later that this is a disorder. It's called body dysmorphia. And she just really couldn't see what the rest of us could see. When she looked in the mirror, she saw this hideous, disfigured face. So the first summer after she started college, Jane swallowed a bottle of pills. And that was really hard for me. But she made it through.
So out of this low point, we follow Jane as she starts to really make strides professionally. And she does brave things like take jobs in Africa and India.
But then later, she's back in Seattle, and a relationship she's in starts to crumble, and she starts to have these physical symptoms that reveal she's still dragging around the weight of anxiety and depression behind her.
She started having these chest pains and started experiencing numbness in her arms, and all of a sudden was starting to feel this weird tingling in her
head. At this point, you might be wondering why we're hearing this story about Jane, and who is Jane anyway?
And the kicker is that it's actually me, so this is my story. It's not Jane, it's Veronica.
And she found herself wandering the streets of downtown Seattle for almost an hour, trying to figure out, well, how do I get home?
I ended up wandering the streets of downtown Seattle for almost an hour.
This is Veronica again, talking in the first person to me in a conference room at her office.
A really long time to process where home even was and how I would get there. It was just terrifying.
You see, Veronica's out, but she's not totally out. And telling the story from the point of view of Jane is, at least in part, kind of a way to ease into that. At one point, she came back to work from a medical leave, and she met with every single one of her office team. One by one, she took them into this same conference room, as a matter of fact, and told them about her mental health challenges. So you might think that talking face-to-face to your coworkers about your mental illness, or standing on a stage and telling a whole bunch of strangers, that would be the hard part, that would be harder than, say, talking about it online or into a radio reporter's tape recorder. But Veronica says it's complicated.
I'm out to everyone in my office. I've told the stories, right, in public places.
So we're only using your first name for this story, Veronica. Why is that? Why would you rather not use your last name?
You know, I'm a little nervous about putting all of this out there for the full world to see in, you know, Googleable form indefinitely, right? At some point, I may be fine with putting this out there completely publicly, but I'm working my way toward that, and I'm not quite there yet.
Do you feel conflicted about these impulses to protect some privacy, but also to come out and cast the stigma off?
Absolutely. 100% for sure, I do.
She's conflicted because she really believes in coming out about mental illness. The hardest thing for her to talk about on stage, which is thinking about or attempting suicide, she believes that is the most important thing to talk about.
Those feelings of not wanting to be around anymore really stem from some really harsh, negative self-talk. And so going there and thinking about that obviously kind of brings those things back, right? And that's really challenging. I think the other thing, though, is that there's such a stigma. And so people don't talk about this stuff. People don't want to acknowledge that we sometimes get into these really dark places. And, you know, it's very rare that I've had people come up and say, hey, let me tell you about this time when I had this kind of experience. And I think that because it's something that we just as a society do not want to address and do not want to talk about, it makes it really scary for those of us who have experienced it.
Veronica is actually part of this organization, which is based in Seattle, called the Stability Network. And it's all about high-achieving professional people talking openly about mental illness. And yet, you won't find Veronica's name on their website or her picture. At least not yet.
Yeah, I think that it's really important to figure out what you're comfortable with and only take yourself as far as you're ready to go at any given time. And don't let anyone else tell you that you have to be fully out or, you know, stay in the closet or whatever.
So for now, Veronica's still emerging from the closet. On stage or in a conference room, she's out. Online and on the radio, she's still partly in. And that, as far as she's concerned, is her choice to make. It's Sound Effect on KPLU. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and we're talking this week about coming out, all the different things we come out about and what that feels like. In this next piece, we're going to be talking about sexual assault. The piece lasts about 10 minutes, and we wanted to give you a heads up about the adult subject matter, as well as a few bleeped words. So, rape is incredibly common. The Justice Department says 18% of women in the U.S. have been raped. And if you think about that stat for a second, if you work in an office with a dozen women, on average, two of them have been raped. It's hard to think about it that way, but the woman we're about to hear from wants us to be thinking about it and talking about it a lot more. Her name is Yara Zaslow, and she was raped while serving in the Peace Corps in Burkina Faso back in 2013. The man she says assaulted her is on trial now, and she's had to fly back to Africa twice already. And she'll probably have to fly back 6 more times over the next 10 years as the trial grinds on. She's writing about her experience now, and she's raising money to help fight the stigma of being a rape survivor. But before she could do that, she had to come out. She talked with Sound Effects senior producer Arwen Nix, and she explained how she first publicly revealed her ordeal in this status update on Facebook.
Well, I feel like this is a bit of a coming out right now. Several of you know that I've been in this super shitty rape trial back in Burkina Faso, and now I found out today that the news I'd be returning soon, as of September 2014, is now sometime in 2016. Because who doesn't want a 30-hour flight that ends in a traumatizing series of accusations from a bunch of homophobic police officers and judges and the accused to ever end? This is year 3 of what will be a 10 to 15-year process. This will be over, and I will have children in middle school. I will be in my 40s. I will be middle-aged. I will never be able to move on because I will always be waiting and waiting and waiting and waiting.
Why did you post that?
I couldn't be alone about it anymore. You know, it is so hard to be sad, but it's also hard to be sad when no one really knows why. And I could no longer live as though I was fine.
So as you're sitting there, getting ready to draft this, what's going through your head? I mean, you have 1,000 Facebook friends. This wasn't going out to just 100 people.
Right.
This was going out to friends and friends of friends.
Absolutely. You know, it's funny. I wrote maybe 15 different things into that little cell on Facebook, and I kept deleting each one because they were all so cryptic. I had said things like, Mondays are the worst, or like, you know, I really need a pizza and a back rub, like something like that. And then finally, I was like, you know what? What am I so ashamed of? Why is what happened to me something that I have to hide? Why? What? This fear of making other people uncomfortable because of my own discomfort, because of my very real pain, it seemed like I was just giving myself like a terrible heartburn and an ulcer or something. So I was like, you know what? I don't want to be ashamed anymore. And I came out.
What changed?
I realized that little by little I would talk about it with people and they would say, oh, you know, that happened to me. And of course, it's a very different, each experience with sexual assault and violence is different. But we're all holding these really tragic stories inside ourselves. And it wasn't until I started talking about it with one person and then another, so much of it comes out and you end up realizing, or at least I ended up realizing that by not talking about it, it was almost like I wasn't trusting that other people had their own stories to tell about it too.
So with this shift in perspective in yourself and the way you've decided to approach coming out as someone who has survived a sexual assault, have you found that with that switch and the way you talk about it, that the reaction from people is different?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I had really thought that I was burdening people. Sometimes I still feel that way. I feel apologetic about it. I think as women, we tend to be socialized to want to apologize for things. You know, I found that I'm not having to protect people as much as I thought I would have to. I'm so afraid of making other people uncomfortable or making people feel sorry for me. I don't want pity. I don't want anything but compassion, I guess, and understanding. People maybe giving me an inch if I'm just being weird or something.
I think that you'd be reluctant to call yourself a spokesperson. But someone who is out there in the public eye talking about surviving sexual assault, do you find that more and more people are coming to you with their stories?
Absolutely.
And how does that make you feel hearing other people's stories?
pretty f***ing pissed off, honestly. I mean, it's awful. It's awful to know how frequent it is, how common it is. That is the hardest part. I mean, when I left my post, by the time the rest of my friends had left, six of us had been sexually assaulted. And many of them didn't report. Some of them only told me. There is this rage. There's this like very visceral rage inside me at this point. And I think the best thing that we can do is just, it's like Dan Savage always says, you know, if you're gay, you got to tell everybody that you're gay, because the only time that queer people are going to have rights is if everybody knows a queer person. I feel like the only way we're going to get recognition and protection for survivors of assault is if everybody knows someone who's been assaulted. And you know what? You do. Every single person you know knows someone. It's just that the numbers are too high and it's too common for you to not know someone.
So you've come out as a survivor of this, but you also came out as gay, and you said that coming out as a survivor of rape was obviously very different, but much more difficult.
Absolutely. I thought coming out as being a gay person would be the most difficult thing I'd ever have to do. And granted, I had to do it a lot and I have to do it every day, but it's always a kind of a party. I'm always I'm always kind of excited about being gay. Like, I love being gay. Like, I want to tell everybody I'm gay. But and I'm not like one of those like quiet gays either. I'm like one of those, like, you know, I'm gay, you know. But coming out about sexual assault is different because there's no pride in it. You know, I'm not proud of what happened. It's not, I'm talking about my partner and that's because I'm gay, let's move on with our conversation. It's, I'm a survivor of sexual assault. How do you need to process this with me? Or like, how can I process this with you? It's complicated. It's a complicated conversation and there's no pride in it.
There's also the idea that there are perhaps some survivors of sexual assault who don't want to think about it anymore.
Of course. And I do not begrudge anybody that. People definitely don't want to think about it. And that makes sense. And I get that. People have different ways of dealing with things. Honestly, who am I to say what anyone's method of dealing with it is? You know, I would never want someone to put themselves in a situation where they feel unsafe, where they feel vulnerable and exposed if that is not okay for them. You know, I mean, this is a question of consent. You know, at what point is it okay for you? Is it comfortable for you to come out? And at what point is it not? I'm never going to tell my grandparents, you know, and I couldn't tell my dad. I had to ask my mom to tell my dad. And the reason I had to tell so many people was because of this trial. But if that trial wasn't happening, would I tell people? I don't know. Probably not.
What do you wish you could have said to people before you told them that you had been raped?
Oh, that's a really good question. I would tell the listener that it's scary to talk about it, not just because you have to relive it, not just because you have to think about it, not just because you have to acknowledge that it happened, but because I think a lot of people, like me, feel like they're burdening the listener. If you're listening to someone tell you that, know that they already trust you.
What happens next? Are you done coming out about this?
I don't think I'll ever be done. That's, you know, that's what gets to me every time. Like, because this trial is so long, I can't really move on. You know, I can't ever stop thinking about it because I have to keep remembering stuff that happened. I have to keep, because if I forget it, I can't, it's not valid in court. You know what I mean? I mean, I don't know what's next. Maybe, I guess it would be nice if I could feel like I could stop living on my toes, you know? If I could stop having such a rapid heart rate and maybe sleep a solid 8 hours. But I don't know if that's going to happen for a while.
Yara Zaslow is a teacher, a queer activist, and a writer. You can read her recent essay about coming out as a rape survivor on our website, kplusoundeffect.org. She spoke with Sound Effect senior producer Arwin Nix. It's Sound Effect on KPLU, and this week we're talking about coming out. And as we've been hearing, it can be a pretty emotionally raw process for a lot of people. But not always. We're about to hear from someone who has to come out over and over again, especially in a place like Seattle. First off, think about these numbers. In 2012, nearly 69% of King County voters went for President Obama versus 28% for Mitt Romney. Drill down to Seattle and then to the UW campus, and you get bluer still. Which is why we want you to meet Ryan Roulier. He's a junior at UW and president of the UW College Republicans. He grew up here in mostly blue King County with liberal parents, and he spoke with KPLU's Ed Ronco.
My dad's very pro-union. He's a union member, and if I say anything bad about unions, or just even a neutral comment on unions, then it would turn into this whole big discussion and he would get upset. My mom used to call me, what was the young conservative guy's on, there was a TV show with a young conservative guy, and what was the kid's name?
Alex P. Keaton.
Yeah, my mom used to call me Alex P. Keaton in high school.
Because of family ties.
Well, I've never seen the show, but just because of the young conservative thing. What would we do?
Are people surprised that you're young and conservative?
Oh, I would definitely say so. They ask, well, how the heck did that happen? Where do your beliefs come from? You probably get it from your parents. They have this assumption that young people can't think on their own, that they have to be indoctrinated one way or the other. I don't necessarily like saying that I'm coming out, because that's such a emotionally powerful thing to do, or a very, you know, emotional thing to do for gay people to come out. So I don't want to equate, you know, coming out as a conservative, coming out as a gay person, because that's much, much harder to do. I would assume it's much more emotional. I don't try to just come out there and say to everyone, oh, I'm a Republican. That's not what defines me. There's much more to me than that. But I'm not ashamed of my beliefs at all. I have no problem saying my beliefs. I don't think it's always necessary for me to do so, but I'm not going to feel bad for being a Republican. I'm really not. The brand can get as bad as it could ever get, and I'll still be proud of my beliefs, because there is moral and intellectual reasons for them.
What's the political climate like on the UW campus? Do you find that there's a base of support for Republican ideas and candidates, or do you have to kind of fight uphill a little bit?
So amongst the Greek system, there's more conservatives for some reason. I'm not quite sure why. It's probably 50-50 liberal conservative in the Greek system. In the main UW student population, it's much, much lower percentage than that are conservative.
Roulier says the atmosphere on campus is pretty friendly, actually, but he does still feel sometimes like he has to tell people he's conservative, and that can pose problems. The vast majority of liberal people he's met don't seem to care. No big deal. But there was this one professor.
He would spend 30 minutes saying how evil Republicans are, how they're ruining the country, blah, blah, blah. And it's just like, dude, shut up and teach the class.
So it's a big lecture.
Yeah. He even asked me at one point, because I can't just shut up and listen to it. I get really angry. And so even though I know I'm outnumbered, I have to at least give an alternative viewpoint. So I'll raise my hand and try and dispute the things he says. And he'll just shut up at that point and then move on, because he won't want to engage.
In that moment when you're in that lecture hall and the guy is spouting off and you're like, okay, it's time for me to... Are you ever nervous about doing that? And not so much because you're talking in front of a bunch of people. I mean, this isn't a stage fright question, but it's more of like a... I guess it's an outing yourself question.
Yeah. I don't typically like outing myself unless... I'm trying to get to know someone, and then I'm, you know, sharing things about me. I don't share my beliefs unless it's absolutely necessary. I do get nervous doing it, particularly if I haven't spoken up in class at all the whole quarter. Yeah, I mean, people, when they hear that you're Republican, half of them assume that you're just a bad person, because the brand is so, so damaged. They automatically assume that you hate women, you hate minorities, you want to give all the money to the rich. There's just a lot of stereotypes about Republicans that aren't true, but people automatically assume when you say you're a Republican.
Do your politics ever come into play in the dating world?
So I've dated all across the political spectrum as well. I've dated very conservative girls, and I've even dated a socialist. So,
wow. How'd that go?
Dated in the past tense, but...
were the politics why, though?
No.
Okay.
No. Politics had nothing to do with it.
That's Ryan Roulier, president of the UW College Republicans, talking to KPLU's Ed Ronco. This is Sound Effect on KPLU. I'm Gabriel Spitzer. And for our last story about coming out today, we're turning to a kind of expert. I don't mean like an academic or something. I mean someone who's come out in private life, but also in a gigantic public way. And that's a pretty good description of Mary Lambert. She's a singer and a longtime Seattleite, and she wrote and sang the chorus on what would become a hugely successful international gay rights anthem. We caught up with Mary in her new home in Western Massachusetts. So, Mary Lambert, when you came out, you were a teenager, as I recollect, and then you kind of came out in a whole new way to the entire planet, basically, when Same Love with Macklemore and Ryan Lewis became a gigantic global hit. How did those two experiences compare with each other?
Honestly, in both aspects of coming out, I thought that it was going to be a lot harder than it actually was. And I know that that's just my experience, and, discrimination is prevalent and different for everybody, for sure. But the things that I experienced the most were more inner demons, especially when I was 17. I came out while I was in the evangelical church. And so I was sort of, I guess my demons were more the indoctrination of, shame and guilt. But when I did Same Love, I think I was prepared for someone to shoot me on a stage somewhere. Like, I just expected, because no one had ever really done this before on such a large scale, especially with a rap song, and I'm the gay one, so, like, I was like, this could be my fate. So I guess I was really blown away and not totally expecting that the song was not only going to be popular, but, performing at the Grammys. I just didn't think that was going to be a thing that would happen as a result of me being, proudly out.
Well, you alluded to a moment ago your church upbringing, and you're still practicing Christian, right?
Yeah.
So, have you ever found yourself having to come out as a Christian in other circles?
Oh, yeah. I mean, that was always the very interesting thing about me as a writer, because I wanted to write a song about being Christian, and because I got asked to write a worship song at one point. And I had the worst time writing a worship song. It was really awful for me. And I spent a whole day just like, come on, just write a worship song. But it felt so far from who I was. It felt really contrived. And in the same way, I got asked to write a gay rights song that was just totally about equality. And I couldn't do it. I also felt equally contrived. And so I found that what I really wanted to talk about and what resonated most with me was talking about love, and coming out in that way is like just kind of a part of living. Like you know, I feel like I come out every day in terms of, there's just so many aspects of my life that are on the fringes of society, I guess, in terms of being, an abuse survivor or a Christian or bipolar, all of these things that make up the parts of me who I am. If I had to consciously think about coming out all of the time, it would be way too overwhelming. So I just exist, and I just hope that the world accepts me for my existence.
And you mentioned a lot of those difficult or complicated parts of your life. Was there one of those that was especially difficult to come out about?
I mean, I think one that I'm probably less forward about and more delicate with is like my childhood sexual abuse and a rape survivor. So me going through those things, it's really, really personal, scary stuff that you have been trying to deal with already in your life. to just have faith in humanity and free fall into the trust of the world is scary.
It sort of sounds like you're trying to get beyond coming out. You're just trying to kind of live your life and not sort of validate the closet by having to come out of it all the time. Am I reading you right?
I guess if I were to categorize myself in different ways, which I think people crave to do anyway, because it's easy to be understood and loved and accepted when you categorize yourself and say, I'm this and I'm this and I fit into this and this is what I look like. And I don't think it's a reduction in any way if you say I'm bipolar and I'm plus size and I'm queer and you put yourself in these with these labels, because that's fine, because, I mean, people want to be understood and accepted and loved for all of their aspects. But I think it does do something. I feel like it does something to your brain when you want to make yourself so digestible, because I think we're so much more complex than we even allow ourselves to believe. And even with all the complexities of labels and sub-labels, we're all simultaneously coming out of something.
Well, finally, Mary, I mean, I have to imagine coming out in such a giant way through the Macklemore and Ryan Lewis song, people must look to you for some kind of advice, or you must get letters from people. I can just imagine. What kind of stuff have you heard from other young people about identity and about coming out?
I've been thinking about this a lot, actually, where someone will come to your show or they'll send you an email and they'll say, I listened to your song and you helped me come out to my parents, or I'm finally in rehab for an eating disorder because of one of your poems. And at the end of the day, like, you can take that home and get, you know, a savior complex and say, look what I did. I am the best. And I make everybody happy and good. But if you take that home at the end of the day, you also have to take the people that say, you know, you didn't tweet me back and now I'm going to slit my wrists. And if you take all of that, then you take responsibility for other people's actions, and that can't be a part of your life. So for me, I think I've come to a place where I really value being a catalyst for someone else's healing. And I love that that's a part of my life and a part of my job.
Well, Mary Lambert, I'm so grateful for you sharing your experiences with us here on Sound Effect. Mary Lambert's a longtime Seattleite, of course, and her latest record is called Heart on My Sleeve. Thanks for being on Sound Effect, Mary.
Thanks for having me.
Sound Effect is produced by Arwen Nix and Kevin Kniestad. Ed Ronco contributed this week. Aaron Hennessy is our executive producer, and we had web help from Mike Lewis. Special thanks this week to Jenny Shortridge and the crew from A Guide to Visitors, Phyllis Fletcher, Wolf Maycutt, and Rebecca Grossman. You can learn more about their storytelling series at our website, kplusoundeffect.org. And while you're there, you can tell us what you think of the show. You can also email soundeffect@kplu.org or tweet at KPLU. iTunes, we're on there. You should go there and check us out. And then come back next week as we consider our five senses and the other dozen or more, too.
Not only do we have these five senses that tell us about the outside world, we have other senses that tell about the inside world, inside of our bodies. For example, blood pressure. We have special receptors in our cardiovascular system that tells us about blood pressure.
I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and this is 88.5 KPLU.